This is the Sunday Catholic Word, a production of Catholic Answers, the only podcast to look at the Sunday Mass readings from an apologetics perspective.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Sunday Catholic Word, a podcast where we reflect on the upcoming Sunday Mass readings and pick out the details that are relevant for explaining and defending our Catholic faith. I'm Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and the host for this podcast. In this episode, we're going to focus on three details that are relevant for apologetical discussions, each of which are found in the first reading, taken from Isaiah 55, 6 through 9, the second reading, taken from Philippians 1, 20 through 24 and 27a, and the gospel reading, taken from Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 16a. The detail from the first reading relates to the problem of evil. The detail from the second reading relates to the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. And the third detail relates to two different apologetical topics, the issue of deathbed conversions and, yet again, the problem of evil. So let's start with the detail from the first reading. After exhorting the wicked to turn from God, who is generous and forgiving, Isaiah speaks on behalf of God in verses 8 through 9, saying, or God speaking through Isaiah, saying this, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. As high as the heavens are above the earth, so high are my ways above your ways, and my thoughts above your thoughts." This idea of God's thoughts and ways being above ours is crucial to overcoming the problem of evil. Often, atheists argue that because we can't see a good that God might bring about from a permitted evil, there is no good. Now, normally, the Christian answer to this objection is that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Think about that. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Although this principle is not always true, it is true in the case of our knowledge of God's providential plan, right? Now, again, that principle can be true sometimes and not true other times. So, for example, there's no elephant in the studio right now. Absence of evidence, right, is evidence of absence in the case of the elephant. Given the nature of an elephant, if it were here, I would see it. Given that it's not here, absence of evidence, I can conclude evidence of absence, it is not here. However, just because I don't see a flea in the studio right now, that doesn't mean there are no fleas, given the nature of fleas and how small they are. Just because I don't see them, that doesn't mean they're not there. So you can see how the principle sometimes is true and sometimes is not. When it comes to our knowledge of God's providential plan, well, then it's going to be true. The evidence, the absence of evidence is not going to equal evidence of absence. Just because I don't see some good that his providential plan involves with a permitted evil, that doesn't mean there is no good. So, moving on. Notice the objection assumes that we ought to see or know the good that God will bring about from the permitted evil. But this assumption is false because to know the complete providential plan of God, which would include the goods that he intends to order permitted evils toward, we would either have to be God in order to know the very essence of God, or God would have to reveal it to us, like tell us what that good is in the providential plan. Since we're not God, and there are some things about his order of providence that he has not revealed to us, we cannot completely know the providential plan of God, which means we can't know some of the goods that he intends to order permitted evils toward. This being the case, it would be wrong of us to expect that we ought to see or know such goods. Now, this answer to the problem of evil maps onto what God says through Isaiah. My thoughts and ways are not your thoughts and ways. In other words, don't expect to completely understand my thoughts and ways. Given your nature as a finite creature, or that's redundant, a creature or a finite being. In other words, we shouldn't be surprised if we don't entirely understand God's order of providence because we're not God. We shouldn't be surprised if we don't understand completely God's overall providence concerning the permitted evil and which good he's directing the permitted evil toward. We can know that there is a good. We can know that through philosophical reasoning and knowing that God is pure goodness itself. So anything that is a part of the order of providence is going to have to manifest as the divine goodness in some way, because all things are ordered to him as their ultimate end. We know that philosophically. And we know in light of divine revelation that all good things are ordered to the good for those who love them, love God, Romans 8:28. So we know that there will be a good, but we don't know the particular good or the specific good. So moving on. The second detail that's worth reflecting on comes from the second reading, which again is taken from Philippians. Let's see here. That would be Philippians chapter 1, verses 20 through 24 and 27a. Paul expresses the conflict that he's expressing his desire to depart this life and be with Christ and his desire to remain on earth to continue ministering to Christians in Philippi. Starting with the end of verse 22, he writes, "I do not know which I shall choose. I am caught between the two. I long to depart this life and be with Christ, for that is far better." Now, some Protestants appeal to this passage to argue that the Catholic doctrine of purgatory contradicts the Bible's teaching on the immediacy of heaven after death. Ron Rhodes is one Protestant who argues this in his book, Reasoning from the Scriptures with Catholics, on pages 240 to 241. Rhodes and others who follow him see in this passage the teaching that a believer enters heaven immediately after death, which of course doesn't leave any room for an intermediate state like purgatory. So what can we say in response? Well, I give several ways that we can respond to this kind of objection in my book, Purgatory is for Real. Yes, it's a shameless plug, I know. Purgatory is for Real, good news about the afterlife for those who aren't perfect yet. You can get it at shop.catholic.com. For our purposes here, I'll share the one that's specific to this passage from Philippians 1. It's important that we first recall the conflict that Paul is expressing. Again, he writes, "I'm caught between the two." So what are the two things he's in conflict about? He's torn between living and serving Christ on earth and being with Christ in heaven. In verses 22 through 23, "If I go on living in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which I shall choose. I am caught between the two. I long to depart this life and be with Christ, for that is far better." Then in verses 24 through 25, "Yet that I remain in the flesh is more necessary for your benefit. And this I know with confidence, that I shall remain and continue in the service of all of you for your progress and joy in the faith." All Paul is saying is that his desire to serve Christ on earth conflicts with his desire to be with Jesus in heaven. Paul doesn't say this union with Christ takes place immediately after death, nor does the context suggest that he intends to say this in some implicit way. Now, our Protestant friend might object, "You're just begging the question, Carlo. I'm arguing that Paul is saying that this union takes place immediately after death because he says, I desire to depart and be united with Christ." In response, the conceptual unity that the two concepts have, departure from this life and union with Christ, doesn't mean they must be simultaneous in time. And just to give credit where credit is due, I am grateful to Jimmy Akin for this line, for sharing this line of reasoning with me. So the conceptual unity of the two concepts, depart from this life, union with Christ, doesn't mean they must be simultaneous in time. For example, suppose I'm at work and I'm wishing I could instead be away from work and at home with my family. Should we conclude from this that if I'm away from work, if I were to be away from work, I must automatically be at home? We got these two concepts, being at work and being at home. Being at work and being away at home, being away from work at home. Given these two concepts, does it necessitate that they must occur simultaneously? Of course not. Doesn't seem like it, right? I could be away from work eating lunch at McDonald's, right? So being away from work doesn't mean I'm automatically at home. I could be somewhere else. eating lunch at McDonald's, why in the world did I use that example? I never eat at McDonald's. Okay, so here's another example. I could be away from work on my way home, but sitting in traffic, which is what I used to do in California, but I don't do anymore in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because there's not that much traffic. Praise be Jesus. So even though there is a conceptual unity between being away from work and being at home with my family, it would be fallacious to conclude that they are simultaneous in time. Similarly, just because Paul desires to depart and be with Christ, that doesn't mean departing this life is simultaneous with being with Christ in heaven. And so this passage from Philippians 1 does not conflict with the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. Therefore, no Protestant can appeal to it as evidence that the Catholic doctrine of purgatory is false or that it contradicts the Bible. Let's now turn to the third detail for this upcoming Sunday Mass reading, which is found in the Gospel. Like I said before, this detail relates to two different apologetical topics. Here's the Gospel reading in full, again taken from Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 16a. Jesus told his disciples this parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out at dawn to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with them for the usual daily wage, he sent them into his vineyard. Going out about 9 o'clock, the landowner saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You too go into my vineyard, and I will give you what is just." So they went off, and he went out again around noon and around 3 o'clock and did likewise. Going out about 5 o'clock, the landowner found others standing around and said to them, "Why do you stand here idle all day?" They answered, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You too go into my vineyard." When it was evening, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Summon the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and ending with the first." When those who had started about 5 o'clock came, each received the usual daily wage. So when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also got the usual wage. And on receiving it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last ones worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who bore the day's burden in the heat?" He said to one of them in reply, "My friend, I am not cheating you. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what is yours and go. What if I wish to give this last one the same as you? Or am I not free to do as I wish with my own money? Are you envious because I am generous?" Thus the last will be first, and the first will be last. Here's the detail that I want to focus on. Jesus approves of the landowner giving the same reward to the late workers as he does the workers who started working earlier, and justifies this by an appeal to the freedom that the landowner has concerning the distribution of his money. As I said, there are two issues that this relates to. The first issue is deathbed conversions. This parable has been interpreted throughout the Christian tradition as Jesus' revelation that it's possible for someone to convert on their deathbed and receive the reward of heaven, even if the person hasn't ever lived the Christian life. But with regard to these types of scenarios, the question is often asked, how does this square with justice? If a person sinned all their life and then repents on their deathbed, isn't there still some temporary punishment due to them? Well, the answer is yes. So then the question becomes, well, how is justice going to be satisfied in those situations when heaven is given to them as a result of their deathbed conversion? Well, there are a few ways, actually, this can play out. One way is that the penitent has such an intense degree of sorrow that the sorrow discharges any remaining temporary debt due for the sins forgiven in that moment. Another possible way is that the penitent is suffering at the time of death and offers that suffering to God such that it's applied to the temporary debt of sin. This is akin to the good thief on the cross who says, "Hey man, you know, we're getting what is due to us." He voluntarily embraces his suffering at the same time of asking the Lord to forgive him and remember him in his kingdom. And Jesus declares that his suffering was sufficient to make up for the remnants of sin, to discharge the remnants of sin, to satisfy the temporary debt due for the past sin. And so it could be that when somebody's on their deathbed, they are suffering and they offer that suffering up to the Lord and unite it to his suffering and thereby discharge temporary debt due for past, for temporary debt of punishment, excuse me, due for past forgiven sin. And finally, such a person may have to suffer in purgatory, right? So if their sorrow is not so intense such that it discharges the temporary debt of punishment, or they're not suffering and uniting it to the Lord such that they discharge the debt of temporary punishment due for past forgiven sin, well, they'll have to suffer it in purgatory. And the suffering in purgatory or the purging would discharge the remaining temporary punishment due for the sins forgiven on his deathbed. So deathbed, the justice that is required for satisfaction of temporary debt of punishment due for past forgiven sins can be satisfied. The debt can be discharged even when somebody repents on their deathbed. So not a problem there. Now, the second apologetical issue is God's goodness, which might be called into question, as in the parable, when we consider that God gives some goods to some people, but not to others. Does this make God unjust and not good? Well, let's think about it. By the way, I can attest that there are some goods that even my fellow apologists have that I do not have. I can't crank out a book every 6 months like Trent Horn can, right? That dude's amazing. And so there are some goods that others have that we don't. Does that make God unjust and not good? Well, I'm going to say no. So let's think about it. God would not be good if and only if the goods that he doesn't give is due to a person, whether on the natural or on the supernatural level. Let's take the natural level first. For example, if per impossible, God were not to give an intellect to a human being, well, then he would not be good. Why? Well, because an intellect is due to a human being in virtue of the kind of thing he is. Or if God were to create man with the natural drive to eat and drink, but never created a substance that could satisfy those inclinations, well, then he wouldn't be good. Our intellect, food, and drink are natural goods that are due to us, though in different ways. Again, God would not be good if and only if the goods that he doesn't give is due to a person, whether on the natural and the supernatural level. Now let's look at the supernatural level. An example on the supernatural level is that if God were not to give the reward of eternal life to someone who did what God said to do by God's grace in order to receive such a reward, like love him, then he wouldn't be good because such a good would be due to the person moved by God's grace to love God. In the parable, the landowner, God, would not be good if he were to have shorted the hired workers the amount of money that they agreed to. Given their agreement, the agreed amount was due to them, and to fail to give what is due is contrary to goodness. Now, if a good is not due to a person and God doesn't give it, then God is not acting contrary to justice. And if God is not acting contrary to justice, then he's doing nothing contrary to his goodness. In the parable, for example, the landowner is not acting contrary to justice in not giving the first hired workers more money because such extra money wasn't due to them. What are some goods that God isn't bound to give us that we often think he is? Well, to use the example of an intellect again, although God is bound in justice to himself and us to create us with an intellect, assuming he wills to create, he is not bound to create us with a certain degree of intellectual acuity. The facility of intellection is a good that is not due to us. Our mode of knowing involves discursive thought and inquiry, which of its nature allows for some shortcomings, not arriving at certain true conclusions. This is why it's not contrary to God's goodness to permit intellectual error, even when it comes to his existence, to the proposition that God exists. Some fall short of affirming that proposition to be true. That is a permitted intellectual error. Is God unjust for permitting that intellectual error? No. Why? because according to our natural rational mode of thinking as rational animals, our natural mode of thinking and reasoning as rational animals involves the possibility to fall short in arriving at the truth. In order for God to prevent us from these shortcomings would be something that is over and above our nature. But if it's over and above our nature, it's not due to us. So God, in not giving us that which is over and above our nature, is not an unjust or non-good God, right? A malevolent God. All right, bodily health and life are other examples that we often think God must give us, and he doesn't, so we think he's not good. God is not bound to preserve us from suffering and death, because suffering and death is part and parcel of our corporeal nature. If God were to preserve us from suffering and death, then he would be giving us a gift over and above our nature, which, of course, is not due to us. Permitting suffering and death is simply God ordering his providence in a way that allows our natures to operate on a natural level without supernatural help. Now, we might not like that, but just because we don't like it, that doesn't mean God is being unjust for not giving us that supernatural help. So yet again, the upcoming Sunday Mass readings don't sell us short when it comes to details that are relevant for doing apologetics. This upcoming 25th Sunday of Ordinary Time, Year A, gives us the opportunity to focus on the doctrine of purgatory, the issue of justice and deathbed conversions, and the problem of evil. As always, I want to thank you for subscribing to the podcast, and please be sure to tell your friends about it and invite them to subscribe as well as at SundayCatholicWord.com. Also, if you're interested in getting some cool mugs and stickers with my logo, Mr. Sunday Podcast, go to shop.catholic.com. My friends, I hope you have a blessed 25th Sunday of Ordinary Time. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to the Sunday Catholic Word. Find more great shows by visiting CatholicAnswersPodcasts.com or just search for Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.